Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 323. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. An amazing show for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Melissa Ferrick is a singer, a songwriter, an entertainer, a headliner, heck, even a professor. She got her first record deal with Atlantic Records when she was just 20 years old, and she has shared the stage over the years with everyone from Bob Dylan to Mark Cohn to Tegan and Sara to Sean Colvin to the Indigo Girls. She has just released her 12th original album to date, entitled, appropriately enough, Melissa Ferrick. She is an 8-time Boston Music Award winner, apparently not letting anybody else win the Boston Music Awards. It's just Melissa Ferrick. And she's a Gay and Lesbian American Music Awards winner. She really is just one of my favorite artists out there and has been for so many flippin' years. Melissa, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Melissa, can no one else win a Boston Music Award other than you?
It's so funny that you say that, because I was actually there up on my third floor. I have a little space that I record in, a little studio at my house. And the last interview I did, they asked me where I kept them all, which I'd never been asked before. And I was like, they're actually like on the floor. And I had moved them up there. And so I was like going through them, looking at what years they were. And I thought, I haven't won one of these since, because I haven't really applied. I stopped applying, because it got a little embarrassing. I felt like that soap opera star that never won, but like got nominated every year, but then she finally won, and it's kind of like, you're going to quit while you're ahead,
I mean, the Indigo Girls were on the show, and they were saying, we just at some point would like to win a Boston Music Award, but we can't because Melissa Ferrick wins all the awards.
That's hysterical.
Well, we have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
Sure, yeah.
Well, let's start with you as we start with all of our singer-songwriters. For our listening audience, Melissa, why the medium of music to get your voice out there?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't know. I remember the first concert I ever went to was Culture Club, because I was obsessed with the drummer in Culture Club.
Yes.
I should have known I was gay then. I was like 13, and it was Culture Club and 10,000 Maniacs were opening, and there's like that moment in a arena show where everyone held up their lighters.
Yeah.
Was before cell phones.
Oh yeah.
And I remember just being like overcome with emotion, and I remember thinking to myself, I want to do this. Like, I want to feel like this every day. And it really didn't matter to me then how I was going to do that, and it still doesn't. I mean, the fact that it's me playing my own music is great, but I do believe I would be doing this in some capacity, whether it was as a manager or as a guitar tech or a merch seller. I love the music business. And so I don't know why voice. It just kind of happened. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have any idea.
From what I understand, there's quite a music background in your family, that this is a business familiar to your family.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, my dad managed bands when I was really young. And I mean, like really young, like four,
yeah.
I was at 4 and 5 years old. I was in bars leaning against speakers, which, this might be illegal now, but at the time in 1975, it was, that was normal behavior. And, he managed bands, and, they were like jazz bands, and it was just around the North Shore.
Yeah.
And my sister, so when I was five, I started playing violin, and my sister was, doing ballet, and she actually went on to become a professional ballerina. My sister was a very good dancer, and so both of us, we were the only two kids, and my parents, neither one of them do anything musical, but I have grandparents who are painters and could play by ear on both sides. My father's mother, my paternal side, wrote songs, and supposedly she has this great story. Well, she's passed on now, but she used to tell me the story all the time, the same story, which was that she entered a songwriting contest on the back of a matchbox and, 1932 or something.
Yeah.
And, it said, please send your song to this address. And so she sent this song, and they stole it.
Oh, gosh.
Their song, and, you know, they never called her back, but it was like...
I do want to be clear, Melissa. It's possible that it was illegal in the 1970s as well for a four-year-old to be in a bar. I just want to put that out there in case anyone listening works for Child Protective Services. She's okay now, folks. Melissa Farrick is okay.
Totally fine. And
totally
fine. It was restaurants. It wasn't like a, you know, it was like restaurant free.
That's fine. You can dial back the story. That's totally fine with us. Was there a certain point where you feel like you gravitated towards a certain genre of music?
Yeah, I do. In high school, it kind of all started in high school because I that was really when I started kind of listening to my own music, like the kind of music I like, you know. And, I mean, this is slightly embarrassing, but I'll tell you anyway because the show is so gay. I will tell you that... I was obsessed with soft rock for like a very long period of time, like into high school, where it wasn't cool to be like going home and listening to Magic 106. And that was what it was in Boston, Magic 106, your home for soft rock. And
oh, yeah.
It was like Sending the Clowns and, you know, Say You, Say Me, Lionel Richie. That was
yes.
a great song. I still love that song. I love like the killer ballad, you know, I really do. And, but then I had this weird phase of being really into like goth rock. So I was like very into Jesus and the Mary Chain, and I got into the Smiths, which I used to save my money and go buy new Smiths records when they came out at the local store. And I wasn't really writing my own songs yet at this point. This was when I was like 13, 14. And then when I hit 15, 85, 86, this record came out called Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians, Shooting Rubber Bands at the Stars.
Oh my gosh,
and
yeah.
That record, First of all, I am Little Miss S, and that's who I am. And so that song, I was like, it's me. She's singing about me, and this is my, you know, this is my angst. And or I want to be, you know, Circle of Friends was a great song.
Huge.
And I just loved her, and I loved the whole story. There was this whole story that, like, when, you know, the record label that signed her didn't want to let her bring her band, but she, like, stood up for them, and she told them, no, I won't make this record unless I can use my own band. And that made me, like, feel like, wow, this woman is like, this is amazing. And then I started writing songs, and then of course the just what at the time seemed like onslaught of female singer songwriters started, you know, Tracy Chapman and Sean Colvin and Katie Lang's cowpunk phase happened, and I was like all for all of it. And that's just I just grabbed the coattails of those women that were in the Indigo Girls. So I mean, my God, that's
huge.
Their first record came out in my freshman year of college, and God, I mean, I wore it out. You can't. It's hard to wear out a compact disc, but man, we wore them out.
Right. Do you remember when people used to ask us, like, "Who are you?" and you would just respond, you know, "What I am is what I am is what I am.
What
you
I
are."
Am.
Yeah.
Totally.
Big. It was big.
And, yeah, it was a huge record, and I've always liked Edie Brickell, and I don't know. I think she kind of like she had that record and. And all those other women came out after, and she kind of disappeared for a while, you
yeah.
know? And, well, now she's married to, like, Paul Simon, I think.
I think so, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Now, as far as the Melissa Farrick canon goes, you were just sitting around one day. I don't know that part of the story. But then all of a sudden, you were opening for Morrissey.
Yes. Yeah. It's this crazy, the crazy thing that happened to me. Yeah. I was 20. It was July 3rd, 1991. And he was on his Kill Uncle tour, and I had moved to New York the year, so I was in college. I went to Berklee College of Music from 1988 till 1990, and then I quit college and moved to New York because this one manager guy heard my song, and I thought that that meant that I was going to be famous, so I quit school and moved to New York.
Of course.
And because that's what you do.
Yeah.
And I lived on a fifth floor walk-up on 14th and 2nd on 3rd with my girlfriend Liz, and... I stopped shaving every part of my body and became a vegetarian and, you know, shaved my head and like did that thing. And then, that didn't work out so good for me. You know, I didn't get famous in a month, and I was working at Chrysalis Records, in the radio department. That was when Sinead O'Connor refused to go to the Grammys. And I was also working at Right Track Recording Studios, answering the phone and living with this girl. And, I remember I called my parents. I don't know if it was at night or in the day, and I was like, you got to come get me. Like, we'll be right there. And my parents drove to New York and picked me up, and I moved everything out of the apartment without even telling her, and I just left.
Wow.
I owed her money, but that's another part of the story, I'll tell you. So I moved back home, and that was like 2 days before I got the call to open for Morrissey. So I had just come back from New York, and I was crashing on the floor my friend Jen's apartment, who was still, she didn't quit school. She was still at Berkeley, and I got a call, you know, from the promoter that was running that show that said, can you be at Great Woods in 45 minutes, which is, and I was like, yeah. And they were like, you're opening for Morrissey. Yeah, so it was crazy. And I gave him my, I had a demo cassette, and I met him. I was introduced to him, and I gave him my cassette. And that was that, you know, and I played the one show, and the next day was the 4th of July. And then July 5th, I got a phone call from his, I think it was his tour manager. I don't really, I know it wasn't him. It was either his tour manager or his manager or someone. And they said, Morrissey listened to your tape, and he really likes the song Hello Dad. He wants you to finish the tour.
Wow.
There'll be a car to pick you up in an hour. And they sent a limousine. And then I was on a plane and being flown to Toronto, and I would then hang out with him for the next 2 months of my life.
Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy.
What did you learn about yourself being on stage in that huge way? My assumption is that you know, my hope is that you know, that one of the things that we all love about you is that, because, you know, I've seen you so many times on stage, you really do have a presence up there on stage. And it's something that the audience can feel. I would imagine that you learned quite a bit about yourself through that experience.
Yeah, I did. And I didn't, you know, what's great about learning like that is that you don't know you're learning.
Right.
And that's the best way to learn, you know, is by doing. I really do believe that. I really wasn't ready for what happened to me, but I was ready in a lot of other ways. And I think that that's what Morrissey saw in me.
Yeah.
He was protective, and everybody that worked for him looked out for me. I couldn't have been treated better. It was an unbelievable experience. I was paid $800 a show, which is like outrageous money for an opening act. I don't even get paid that now when I open for big people.
Yeah.
You know, I stayed in the same hotel that he, if it was a Ritz-Carlton, which it usually was, or a Four Seasons, I was staying there too.
Wow.
They really just, I learned so much about how to treat people, how to not be better than, but not be worse than, how to talk to stage monitor guys, how to talk to the people that are working at the venues. You know, how to find your dressing room. I mean, all of it. How to, at the after shows, I mean, for those Morrissey gigs where, I mean, I was hanging out with like Chrissy Hynde and Michael Stipe and having dinner at De Niro's restaurant. I mean, I was like around really famous people,
wow.
You know, and it was just, I just learned so much. I had no idea. And I remember being in England somewhere. So we did the U.S. and then we went to England, and I was touring around somewhere in England with him, and it kind of dawned on me that this was the lead singer of the Smiths. That,
yeah.
Like, I was on tour with a guy. Like, I was in England in a car, like, driving to Wembley for a guy whose name I used to write on my jeans.
Right.
You know, in high school. I used to, like, write the Smiths on my jeans. And, like, it was totally, I think I understand it and appreciate it more now than I did at the time. At the time, I just was like, well, of course this is happening to me. Like, because that guy said that I was going to be famous, and so I moved to New York, and so I'm then, you know, but it's just like, you know, one of the things at Berkeley that's fun is, well, there's a lot of things that are fun, but a lot of the faculty members that have had these moments where, and then the phone rang, like one of Beyonce's singers teaches at Berkeley, and I remember when she introduced herself, when new faculty members come in, they say a little bit about themselves, and in her spiel, she said, you know, and then the phone rang, and it was Beyonce's crew, and I was on a plane, and I was being flown to Brazil. And then the next guy, you know, who made records for the Pixies, you know, stood up, and he was like, so, you know, I owned this recording studio and made records for everybody that didn't have any money. And then one day I got a call, and there was this band called the Pixies. So I, you know, it was just the same story. And then I was like, well, I was sitting around, and the phone rang. So I think that, you know, it's, you can prepare, but you really, a lot of it is luck.
Yeah.
Lot of it is just being in the right place at the right time. And then being able to show up and be consistent, you know, at that time when I was 20, you know, I wasn't having any trouble with booze yet. I wasn't, I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't have, any responsibilities. I was well behaved. I was relatively well behaved. You know, I mean, I had a really good time. I showed up where I was supposed to be, you know, I was responsible. I wasn't letting, other parts of my life take over. I just did the job that was given to me. And there's a lot to be said for that. You know, 90% of life is showing up. So
I
definitely did that.
I love it. You know, one of the things that I love about you is that you're just so open in any number of interviews of just talking about this is not a cakewalk business, this music business. How do you talk to Berklee students about, or just anybody you're speaking to about how to navigate this really tricky business for which you've had these, you know, amazing ups and downs?
Yeah, I tell the truth, you know. My truth, and I, you know, I just talk about what's happened to me and how I've handled it, and sometimes that hasn't been gracefully, you know. I mean, I've made mistakes, and I've continued on, and I've not continued to make the same mistake, you know what I mean? Where it's like, okay, like you're allowed to screw up as long as you change it, you know.
Right.
And one of the things I talk about, there was a lecture recently where it was on DIY independent touring, and it was to incoming freshmen. And one of the things I kind of started off on was just like, okay, so, you know, just plan on, you know, not being home for Thanksgiving, you know, not going to any of your nieces and nephews' birthday parties. You're just not going to see them grow. You know, just like all of the things that you're going to miss. You're going to miss everything. You will play shows on your birthday. You will drive 9 hours, you'll get out of a car and you will walk on stage. You will sleep in bad hotels. You will eat poorly. Your body will suffer, you know, and, you know, on and on about just the kind of the things that are mostly physical and mental that you put yourself through. But what remains pure is the art, you know, and I think that that's really important to remember is if you really do love writing songs and you do love playing live, you know, that hour or hour and a half on stage that you get, or if it's a half hour, if you're opening, you know, you really do have to live for that. And it's just taken me a really long time to learn how to take care of the other aspects of my life so that I can be as prepared as, you know, as healthy as I can be to be able to play. I don't have having the experience of touring in buses, like when I get to go on tour with Ani DeFranco, you know, those tours that I get with her are extraordinary for a number of reasons, but I think she understands for me, the biggest reason is that I don't have to drive, and I'm fed really well, and I'm safe, and you know what I mean? And that, those two things being taken, or I don't have to book all of the hotels, it's huge. It's a huge thing. So when you have an artist that gets very famous very quickly, they don't go through those years of struggle and routing and booking hotels and figuring out if you need to go to a grocery store to get peanut butter and jelly because they're going to give you a pizza at the club. And if you eat one more pizza, you're going to, like, you know, take another year off your life.
Right.
you know, you don't move your body. You move maybe, you know, 80 steps that day because you're walking, you're barely walking, you know, cause you're just in the vehicle. And so when you get really famous really quick and just get in the bus and you get the catering and you're eating with real silverware every night and you don't go through living a single serving life the way I have, I think it seems easier. It's like, oh, well, this is cool. Like, I can do this. Cause that's how it was with Morrissey too. You know, it was like a car came and picked me up. I'm at the Ford. It was like, oh, this is going to be a no brainer. And then it was like, oh no, what do you mean? It's not like this all the time. And then, like, to keep that up, like, I think about that with the Indigo Girls. I think about that with Ani. It's like, those buses are expensive, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to keep, you have to be making a certain amount of money to keep up that lifestyle so that you can play.
Right.
So that your body doesn't break down and your brain doesn't break down, you know? And you don't play shows anymore because you can't stand it, you know? It's not that you can't stand playing. It's that you can't stand driving, seven or 8 hours a day. It's... you know, every day, not just one day, but every day. So it's a lot.
I love the idea that you are 20 years old and you already got used to the idea of looking around and just seeing Chrissy Hynde just everywhere you go. It's great.
Oh my God, it was amazing. First of all, she's like the greatest thing that ever happened. I mean, I think Chrissy Hynde is just like the best. She didn't even really talk to me. I didn't even care. I just was like standing near her. I think she said like one thing to me, like she's not a good kid or something like that, you know?
She remembers you. She remembers you as the intern who kept staring, you know? But it turns out, no, you were opening for Morrissey. That's what was happening, Chrissy.
Yeah, right, yeah. When I played The Garden with Morrissey, right after my set, I was in my dressing room and Michael Stipe came running in with eyeliner streaming down his face, and he was jumping up and down. And he was like, "You're amazing! You're amazing!" And I was like, "Holy crap! That's Michael Stipe!" Like, because they were so famous. Like, that was when Document was out, you know?
Oh yeah.
I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe it. I was like, my sister was there. We were like, she just grabbed my hand, and I was like, "Holy Michael Stipe!"
I love it. I love it.
And he likes me. You know what I mean? Oh my god.
I mean, I don't know that I would be able to see Michael Stipe without just saying, all right, and now we're doing Kid Fierce. Let's get back out on stage. This is what we're
exactly,
going to do. That's
exactly
what we're going to do.
I was like, we should do that as the encore, and I'll be Amy.
I just wake up and pretend I'm Amy. So it's my baseline. That's fine. That's fine, Melissa. Now, you are calling in right now to this show is So Gay. I have to be honest with you. I really, you know, for as many years as I've been following you, I really only know you as an out artist. Was there a non-out artist, Melissa Ferrick?
There was. It was very brief, but there was. And it was on my first record in 93, Atlantic hired and opened the first gay marketing division at a major label. And they hired this amazing guy named Peter Galvin. Do you know him?
I don't.
He's a great guy. He was a writer for a lot of magazines, but he did a piece on me for Detour magazine, out gay guy. He owns his own publicity company now. I don't know the name of it. But anyway, his name's Peter Galvin. Gorgeous and fantastic. You can probably Google him and figure it out. But anyway, they hired him, and I was like, this is amazing. I love Peter, and he already likes me. And they wanted me to come out, and they wanted to promote my record through this gay marketing division, and I didn't want to do it. And I was scared. I was 22. Yeah, 22. I mean, when I was 20, when I left college, I was 19. And when I left college, I had a boyfriend and a girlfriend. So I was... knew that I was queer. I wasn't ready to identify as any particular. I didn't want to pick one. I still don't like picking one.
Right.
But I was just very confused. You know, I didn't really know. And then they were going to use this thing to like this thing, me. You know.
Yeah.
This part of me to promote it, and that felt really weird. And so I said no. Needless to say, Jewel said yes, and of course we all know what happened with that record, which it just did terribly, didn't it?
I think there was the one guy who heard it once, you know, maybe something like that. Yeah,
maybe it won a Grammy. I don't know.
But did it win a Boston Music Award? No, I don't think it did.
It absolutely did not. No, it didn't. It's crazy how those straight people who use gay marketing win lots of awards, isn't it?
It's amazing.
But, yeah, what a gay marketing division is really for straight artists that want the gay people's money. But anyway, I said no, and then I was in Ireland on a show, I remember, because my girlfriend at the time, her name was Nancy, and she had given me a ring to wear, like a commitment ring, and I had it on my left finger, and the guy was interviewing me. I was in Dublin, so I must have been on tour with John Hyatt at that time. Oh, no, it was Dwight Yoakam, actually, even better. And he said, so I see you're wearing a ring. Are you married? And my stomach dropped.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm married to my music, which is, first of all, I would never say anything like that. It's just not even interesting. And it was a lie. And I remember thinking then, like, oh, I got to do something about this.
Yeah.
So I went to the guys at Atlantic that I was working with, my A&R guy, Tim. And I said, I want to come out publicly. And so we did. And I did the articles. You know, it's funny because when you come out, it's like you just, you do articles. Maybe it's different now or whatever, but. You know, basically it just meant that we were calling up all the gay magazines and doing cover stories with them to let all of the gay people know that I also knew I was gay, which all the gay people already know I'm gay.
Right.
Like, it's not really, you know, I talk about, like, people that make an impact, like, when they come out, like, Melissa Etheridge, you know what I mean? Like, having a billboard in the middle of Times Square with Julie with a snake wrapped around you is kind of amazing. You know? Like, that's coming out, you know what I mean? Like, that's amazing. Ellen, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, like, my coming out was like, oh, yeah, we knew she was gay. So I was on the cover of Out Magazine, awesome. You know, my mom thought it was cool, you know, like, whatever. But, you know, it was just, yeah, it was what it was. So that happened, and then it was like, it was over, and nobody ever really asked me much about it again, really.
Yeah. And here we are. And now you're on this show with So Gay.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, we have to talk about the new album. Now, I have to ask you what all of our listeners must be asking. Did you just run out of names for albums? And you just said, well, you know, screw it. I'm just going to name it after myself.
Yeah, so this is a great question. And there's a kind of a long answer, shocking, that I have this A&R division, which are my fans, that are the people that put the money up for me to make this record. I made them my A&R team. And so what I did was, we have a website that I built and copywrote and everything, which is really cool, this new platform. And so what I do is I can go on there and communicate with them and ask them questions like, do you think I should make T-shirts? And if I do make T-shirts, should I use American Apparel or should I use this company? Yeah. Or how important is U.S. made? Blah, blah, blah. So, and I posted all of the photographs that Shervin took, like unedited, you know, the top 15 photographs that Shervin had sent to me. And then I said, please put these in order of the one you like the most, the least favorite. And one of the other questions was, here are the titles of the songs. What should I name the album? And it was one of the people that said, why don't you self-title it?
Nice.
This record sounds so much more like you than anything I've heard since The Other Side. And this is a real coming home. You know, you're reopening the label. You're doing this yourself again. And it's like a restart. And it does feel like a restart in a lot of ways. And I thought, and then everybody chimed in on her comment, you know, and they were like, that's actually really good. What do you mean you've never self-titled? And I don't know. 12 is a good number. You know, my lucky number is 21. It's 12 backwards. And I'm weird like that. So I went with it. And it feels really good. It feels good to have a self-titled album.
It feels like, you know, there's so many different words I can use to describe the album. My hope is that the word authentic resonates with you, because it just feels like an authentic album.
Thanks. Yeah. God, that's the biggest compliment I could get. Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's make you do what so many of your colleagues have done before you on this show. This is that part of our show where we will ask you, Melissa Farrick, and we'll only make you do it twice, to do a little self-analysis, a little Melissa Farrick on the therapist's couch. You're going to tell our listening audience what a couple of your songs say about Melissa Farrick. If we played these for a therapist, what you think that they would say about you, the artist. Are you ready?
Okay.
Yeah. We'll do one old one and one new one. I can't have you on this show, Melissa, without asking you about Everything I Need, which is a song that got me through more tough times than I could possibly tell you. But what does the song Everything I Need say about Melissa Farrick?
That song probably says that this is a person who is trying to find the smallest things that they have to not go off the deep end. And this is a person that's just kind of trying to recenter, you know, and think about, even if it's the smallest thing to be grateful for, just which at the time was a very, very low bank account balance. I think it was like $108. And I had a car. And that Cat Stevens song always spoke to me. So I thought about that. The song was written as a direct suggestion by a friend of mine who said, I was having a really hard time. And she said, when we get off the phone, I want you to write down all the things that you're grateful for and all the things that you have. And so I wrote, I have money in the bank. Even if it's not a lot, I had it. And I have a car to drive, and I have a working set of hands, you know, and my guitar seems to like it. I've got love that won't quit, which is true. I had love in my life, you know, from my family and friends and all of it. So I think that's what it would say, which is just like, here's a person who's willing to seek anything to stay here, you know, and to stay on point and to stay focused and to move forward. So tenacity.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. All right, let's make you do a new one, though. It is my favorite track off the album. I enjoy all the songs, but this is the one. What does the song Scenic View say about Melissa Farrick?
Thank you for that. That's my favorite song on the record, too, I think, besides Careful. This is a new style of writing for me. This is me really kind of lyrically taking a stand and coming out a little bit. And even just being solid in who I am. I know who I am, and I know what's right and what's wrong for me. And I trust myself with my own decisions, and that there is a, you know, the future looks amazing, and there is a reason to continue pushing on. So I think for me, that's really what Scenic View stands for. For me, I stumbled upon it kind of becoming a bit of which is becoming a bit of an anthem, which is really nice for queers. And I didn't mean it that way when I wrote it. It really was about some turmoil. I guess turmoil is not the right word, but some backlash from a family member of my girlfriend who wasn't all too thrilled that that she was with a woman. And I just was so shocked. I was like, this is the first time in my life I've ever had a relationship with someone where I've come up against homophobia.
Yeah.
And so having not experienced that, I mean, I'm 44 years old. That's a long time to go without having, you know, I've been very lucky. My response to that was not in anger. It was, wow, he's going to be really sad. It's going to be something he's really sad about to feel that way. And so that line came from there, you know, people who don't want to see our happiness must be deeply sad. And I think that this song probably expresses, I could see this as if I wasn't me, I could see, well, this is a person who can see another person's hurt, you know?
Absolutely.
I'm working on a song right now called Hurt People, Hurt People. And I think that I'm much more capable now of kind of seeing that when people react in a way that I don't want them to or don't think they should. I don't go to, I'm mad at them and they're an idiot. I go to, wow, they must be in pain, you know?
Yeah. There you go. That scenic view. I won't make you analyze it. I will just put out there that although everyone here at this show is so gay, we all do believe that sexual orientation is not something that we choose. I do think that at some point somewhere, someone wasn't gay and then they heard the song Drive and then they were gay. I just want to put that out there.
I've met many, many male bartenders with girlfriends who then, after watching me play Drive, then brought their girlfriends to the next show.
Yeah.
And then that girlfriend would pick up, you know, would be gay that night.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just putting it out there. We believe that sexual orientation is biological unless Drive is playing, in which case it is a different thing.
Everyone's gay. When I played that song for my parents when the record was done, because I always play them my records, and they sat on the couch in front of me with their eyes closed the entire time, and they loved the song. And my mother said, what I love so much about this song is that you never identify a gender.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought that. And I was like, well, I say hips. And she was like, but men can have hips.
Yeah.
Men have, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's really cool. And she was like, I love that about that. So you really can just like close your eyes and go to whoever it is for you,
yeah.
You know, which I thought was brilliant. My mom's wicked smart.
Of course she is. I just will say that I am very gay. I am proud of my sexual orientation. I will say for 6 minutes and 35 seconds while listening to Drive, I am a lesbian each and every time. I love it.
Good.
I love it.
Fantastic.
All right, listeners, this is what you guys need to do. First, you, of course, need to stroll on over to iTunes and download this new album. Authentic doesn't begin to describe it. You are so accessible throughout this album, and these are songs that are going to make you pause during the day. So everybody, go to iTunes, go download it. You, of course, listeners, must go to melissaferrick.com, and you can read all about her, and you can buy merch, and you can watch videos. So much going on there. I have to tell you, Melissa, I mean, this is such a treat for me to have you on the show. I usually have all this praise at the end, but I'm actually going to use your own words. And this is a quote that you have up there on the Berkeley site. And I feel like it just summarizes your place in my life and your place in so many different listeners' lives. You said this quote, "And I want to make sure that the next 17-year-old girl who doesn't know who she is yet and is terrified and is writing these songs in her bedroom, saving her own life, has a place she can go where someone's going to say, this is exactly what you're supposed to be doing and you're great. Yes, play that song live for us." Melissa, that's what you have done for me. That's what you have done for so many listeners. It's such a treat to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. That's really kind.
Listeners, go download the album. Melissa, please, please keep doing what you're doing.
Okay, I will. I definitely will.
I'm gonna let go with everything I've got. I'm gonna let you see me. 'Cause if I believe that nothing is stronger than love, then I give this everything I've got.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, last week, there was this rainbow explosion, and maybe not where you expected it to happen. Here to talk all about an insanely successful campaign that dominated both social media and the snack aisles is Brett Peters, the Director of Communication at the It Gets Better Project. Brett, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Before we even talk about the rainbow explosion, let's start with the It Gets Better Project. Tell everybody, if for some reason they haven't been, you know, paying attention in the past couple of years, tell everybody about the project.
So actually, yesterday was our 5th year anniversary.
Wow.
So 5 years ago, Dan Savage and his now husband, Terry Miller, uploaded a video to YouTube in response to a lot of young people who are either LGBT or perceived to be LGBT taking their own lives. Dan is an internationally syndicated sex columnist and relationship advice expert, and he posted a column on The Stranger and about, you know, what had been going on. And someone commented in the comments, you know, I wish someone just told that kid that it gets better, and it really resonated with him. And so him and his partner, Terry, uploaded a video to YouTube saying just that, that, you know, if you can kind of get through this tough time and find a community of support and people who will take you in and, you know, support you along the way, that life can and will get better.
Nice.
And then he encouraged his readers and his followers to do the same. And from there, it just completely turned into this huge phenomenon. One video became 100 videos, became 1,000 videos, became now 60,000 videos created, viewed over 60 million times. Videos made by our president, corporations, everyday people, celebrities, sports teams, you know, anyone can upload a video and share their message of hope and support.
I love it. How did you come to be involved with the project?
So I actually started as a volunteer a little over 4 years ago, and I just kind of never left.
There you go. That's how it happens sometimes, Brett.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just tell everybody, what does the Director of Communications do?
So actually, I do probably, I do communications and then some. So I oversee all the social media. I also help create some of the programming, and I also manage all of our corporate relationships and partnerships.
I would imagine you like it a little bit.
I do, yes. That's why I've stuck around for sure.
All right. Well, I mentioned it in the intro. We're talking about Doritos, Brett. I don't know that in 7 years of this show I ever anticipated, oh, yeah, we're going to do a segment on Doritos, but here we are talking about Doritos.
Yes, we are. You know, I'm not sure if I would have been expecting to have this conversation either, but I couldn't be more excited to talk about it.
Where do we start? Where did this partnership start?
So Doritos reached out to us a few months ago saying that, you know, they're creating this chip and they want to use it as a way to support the work that we do. And from there, we just kind of hit the ground running with how we were going to create it, how we're going to get the word out there about it, and, you know, the type of activations we'd be doing around it.
How do we determine if we say yes to such a proposal? I would imagine there was a meeting somewhere where some folks had to sit down and say, wait, okay, are we going to work with Doritos? Yes, we're going to work with Doritos.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, whenever a corporate partnership, potential corporate partnership kind of comes to us, we do our research and we make sure we check the HRC Corporate Equality Index to make sure that everything is good there, and they have 100% score.
Love it.
And so, you know, we take that list very seriously. And so after doing our due diligence, we said, yes, of course, let's do it.
I love it. All right. So we're talking about Doritos Rainbows. I was not able to get a bag in my hands. I would hope at some point Brett Peters had a bag of Doritos Rainbows in his hand.
I did, yes. Well, we, you know, I just got back last night from Dallas because we did a huge activation at Dallas Pride, and it was honestly one of the most amazing experiences for the organization and for me personally to see, you know, people's faces and be with people in person, you know, seeing these chips for the first time and telling you know, my staff and the people at Doritos and the people at the advertising agency, just how excited they are about this, how, you know, it really is given so many people hope. So many young people came out to us and told us that it saved their lives, not necessarily the Doritos partnership, but the It Gets Better project. And the fact that Doritos was able to elevate our message is really phenomenal.
And talk to me about that piece. How does this help elevate your message?
So, I mean, just the amount of media exposure has been insane.
Yeah.
You know, when the project first started, we, you know, were kind of all over the news. And since then, you know, we've really been focusing on our programmatic work and how we, you know, make it a sustainable nonprofit organization. And, you know, to have this happen days before our five-year anniversary, and to really just have our name back in the conversation, that people talk about the work that we do and the importance of our message, it's just a really great way to enter our fifth year.
Yeah. And to be clear, 100% of the proceeds going to the It Gets Better project.
100% of the proceeds.
That's a large number, Brett. I would argue it actually doesn't get higher than that.
I would have to agree with you.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Now, the big news is that it was such a successful campaign that it's just sold out, correct?
That is correct. Within 24 hours, our online campaign sold out.
How do you wrap your mind around that?
To be honest, it's just me and the rest of my staff are just totally dumbfounded, but also so excited and surprised and honored that people just, you know, rush to their computers to support what we do and to get a limited edition bag of these chips that are awesome, taste delicious.
Yes.
And, but you know, a lot of people are using them as collector's items too, which I think is fabulous.
I'm not saying that you and your staff didn't sit around and think, okay, this is going to be successful. But I would have to imagine once the numbers started rolling in, you guys were looking at each other and saying, and the media coverage, which was incredible, you had to have looked at each other and said, whoa, look what's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I will say, you know, the amount of work put into it.
Huge, yeah.
Definitely, I'm not like surprised that you look at those kind of results. It was just so incredible that the result actually happened, right? Because you never really know how it's going to go until it actually goes live.
Yeah.
And so to see the work pay off was really gratifying.
What was the most surprising or gratifying tweet or media coverage that maybe you didn't see coming that you were so pleased with?
I think it's really just the volume.
Yeah.
I think that was the most incredible part about it is the volume of support and people just so excited about it and, you know, people kind of reflecting on how It Gets Better has affected them and, you know, just getting people to put it back in the conversation and talking about how helpful it's been for them.
Yeah. Yeah, because I would imagine there's been quite an arc to the It Gets Better project. You know, it started out with Dan and his partner and his now husband, and then there was a little bit where, you know, there were all these folks who were unknowns creating videos, and then it felt like, okay, then there were some celebrities getting on the bandwagon, which brought a lot of exposure, but also there's certainly, you know, to be fair, and we've talked about it before on the show, there certainly were moments of saying, okay, yay for all this exposure, but are we getting back to the message of people just saying, I swear to you, it will get better? And so I would imagine this whole campaign has helped refocus on those efforts.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, something that a young woman said in one of her videos that Dan and the whole rest of the team loves is, you know, it doesn't get better, you get stronger.
Yeah.
And that is definitely something that we take to heart, and that it, you know, it gets better by getting stronger. It gets better by finding a network of support and connecting young people with resources that get them over that finish line. And so, you know, the work that we do isn't just simply telling people it gets better, but it's helping to connect them with that network and get them the support and resources that they need.
I love it. I love it. Now, are there talks to maybe expand the run here or expand the offerings, or can we just say this is sold out and yay?
So you'll have to stay tuned, and you know, there's some additional exciting information.
I love it.
And about our partnership, so definitely stay tuned.
I'm gonna stay tuned. What's coming up next for you? So obviously, this was a hugely successful campaign. What else should we be keeping our eye on, other than Doritos?
So we have a really exciting initiative for our 5-year anniversary that I can't share just yet.
Okay.
But it's going to really get people sharing their stories again.
Nice.
And hopefully create a new wave of young people that are going to hear our message and really take the time to reflect on the last 5 years and also think about the work that's still left to be done.
Nice. What has it meant for you personally, Brett, to just be involved in these efforts?
It really, you know, I think everyone's lives have gotten better in the last 5 years overall.
Yeah.
Thinking about the amount of support and change and inspiration that's happened in the last 5 years. You know, I think it's to be LGBT and just see the amount of visibility in the media, to see the amounts of policy that's been changing, I think that to be a part of that change has just been, you know, such a highlight for me.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. All right. Well, you have all of our listeners listening to you right this second. What can they do to support your efforts? Right this second, they can't order more Doritos, but we'll stay tuned. What can they do to support the It Gets Better project?
So, you know, definitely still taking donations for our work, but
yeah.
Definitely find us on social media. Follow us. Stay tuned for what we have coming up next. And just be ready to share your story, and you know, because that's really what helps create change, is people sharing their experiences with others, because I think when a young person sees themselves on screen, when they can identify with a person who has a similar, you know, experience to them, that's how we give them support, and that's how we, you know, inspire change.
There it is. There it is. Listeners, everybody, stroll on over to itgetsbetter.org. There's tons of links there. You can watch the videos. Did you say 60,000 videos we're up to?
Yes, we're up to 60,000 videos.
Unbelievable. Now, have you done one yourself, Brett?
I actually haven't, no. You know, there's something, you know, I think to be said just about having that behind-the-scenes type of experience with the project. I haven't made one, though.
All right, what I hear you saying is that by the end of the day, it's going to be 60,001, and we're going to watch Brett's video.
Maybe we'll see. It's
pretty
busy around here.
I bet. Everybody, itgetsbetter.org. Brett, to you and your staff and your team and everybody over there, huge congratulations on this. This was so exciting. I loved seeing this just dominate social media and just dominate the news waves and rainbow Doritos everywhere. Huge congratulations on this. I hope it furthers the work because this really is important work. We have loved following this project over the years and we want it to keep going. So you guys keep doing what you're doing.
Well, that means the world. Thank you so much for saying that. We can't wait to show you what's going to happen next.
Itgetsbetter.org. Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
None of this really makes sense. So just come in and close the door. Let's leave it all for something else. Show us what it is we're in for. All the way across this room, I just gave myself to you. And every love I've ever had, I want to thank for getting me to you. Every love I've ever had, I want to thank for getting me to you. I'm gonna be careful, careful, careful.
All right, folks, not a lot of time left on this week's episode, but we will hit just a few of the big LGBT news stories that are out there this week. The huge, huge story, President Obama is nominating a gay man to lead the army, and if confirmed, the nominee would become the first openly gay civilian secretary of any branch of the military on more than an interim basis. Obama's nominee, announced this week, is Eric Fanning, who has, quote, been a specialist on defense and national security issues for more than 25 years in Congress and the Pentagon. That's according to the Washington Post. As secretary, he would head the Army in partnership with General Mark Milley, who is the Army's top general. And a statement released by President Obama said this, quote, Eric brings many years of proven experience and exceptional leadership to this new role. I look forward to working with Eric to keep our Army the very best in the world. So Eric Fanning now awaits confirmation by the Senate. Fanning has previously served as the interim secretary of the Air Force, and since this past June, he's been the acting undersecretary of the Army. This is very, very exciting news. This is a huge, huge glass ceiling that is being broken through there in the military with President Obama nominating a gay man to serve in this role. I mean, for all the folks who say, oh gosh, President Obama could have done more, I really don't know how. The amount that this president has done has been extraordinary for the LGBT community. I feel like there was a time a few years ago where we were questioning that. I feel like if you go to thisshowisogay.com and maybe tune into the show, say 5 years ago, we were really questioning, okay, what is this president doing? Is he really taking any risks on behalf of the LGBT community? Is he really making a difference? And at this point, it's just undeniable what a huge difference he has made in the march towards equality, in the march towards guaranteeing our safety, just in the march of change for our LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. So much under President Obama. Very exciting. Very exciting. And even more, he's done even more. A Roman Catholic teacher who was fired over her same-sex marriage, she says that she has been invited to the White House, you know, where President Obama lives. She's being invited there to help welcome Pope Francis. Margie Winter said this week that she hopes the pontiff will address issues facing gay Catholics during his visit to the U.S. this week. The 50-year-old Winters says she lost her job this year at a private Catholic grade school outside Philadelphia over her 2007 same-sex marriage. We certainly covered this story on the show. Thousands of people from diverse social and religious backgrounds are expected to attend the welcoming ceremony this week on the South Lawn. Winters hopes to get a chance to speak to the Pope. She would ask him to extend his message of inclusion to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Catholics. She says that her invitation came through the Human Rights Campaign, but obviously had President Obama's endorsement therein. So exciting there. So she was fired, but maybe she gets to meet with the Pope now. So that's pretty exciting. That's pretty exciting. Azalea Banks, I got to tell you, I really barely know Azalea Banks other than her place in pop culture. I don't know her music that much, but she is certainly under fire, certainly under fire yet again for her homophobic actions, and we're just labeling them homophobic. After a TMZ of her spat with a flight attendant went viral, she found herself on the receiving end of a lot of hatred due to her use of the word faggot. We do not endorse that use at all, but that is the word that she used. It was presumed to be an insult, and if you watch the video, she is yelling not just that word, but there's a cuss word in front of it that we can't say. I don't even know if we can say that F word that I did just say, because it's a terrible word, and it's not a word that we want to use, and it's a word that's connected with violence. So a lot of people are saying, yeah, this was incredibly homophobic. She is now responding on Twitter. And she's saying that she was harassed, and she's reminding people that she is bisexual, and she is reminding people that her brother is trans, and she said, my employees are all gay men. So, and then I will say, she ends that tweet. This is the tweet. I am bisexual. My brother is trans. My employees are all gay men. Nothing else to say. That's the tweet. I will say, none of that, whether your brother is trans, your employees are all gay men, or you are bisexual, I don't know any of those to be true. I don't know Azalea Banks. None of those. give you the right to call, especially if you identify as being a part of the LGBT community, to call another member of the LGBT community that violent F word, and to do it in a way, I can't stand it when people use that word in even in some sort of friendly way. I don't like that. That's not something I enjoy. But this was not used in that way. If you watch the video, this was Azalea Banks hurling that word as an insult. So I don't care if you are bisexual. I don't care if your brother is trans. I don't care if your employees are all gay men. And when you say there's nothing else to say, yes, what there is to say is, I'm sorry, that's not a word I should have used as an insult. As someone who's bisexual, whose brother is trans, and who all my employees are gay, I should know better than that. So we will see. We will see if she comes out with the requisite apology that usually comes with such things, but she should know better. She should know better. If she's going to say, I'm a part of this community, then you know not to hurl that word as an insult at any of her LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. It's horrible. Horrible stuff. And finally, in North Carolina, the owner of a North Carolina bar has come under fire for reportedly kicking a gay couple out of her establishment for kissing, but she contends she would have done the same thing to a heterosexual couple. Andrew Duras and Dustin Baker said that they were asked to leave Louis Sports Pub in Fayetteville, North Carolina on September 18th after what they described as a quick kiss. The Fayetteville Observer reported that Baker said he also had his arm around Duras, but that both were dancing and singing together and interacting with other people in the bar. Duras, who was visiting his boyfriend from California, told WRAL that Griffin threatened the couple, said this, quote, "He put his arm around me, he gave me a kiss, and she said, this wasn't right, this wasn't okay. It was very minor, it was just a peck, it was 2 seconds. Bar owner Pam Griffin, however, has a different story. She told local ABC affiliate WTVD that several Louis customers had complained about the extent of affection the two men were sharing in the bar. When she asked the couple to tone it down, Griffin said one of them gave her the middle finger and cursed her before they began French kissing. Why am I covering this story? So I'm actually covering this story because it oddly indicates progress. It would have only been a few years ago that a bar owner would have stepped up and said, yeah, no, that's totally why I kicked him out. It was two men and they were kissing. That a bar owner is even stepping up and saying, no, I would have done this to a straight couple. As horrible as the story is, and look, I hope that the truth is somewhere in the middle of these two things, but it's actually an oddly progress. It's a horrible story. Let's not kick people out of the bar if they're showing a tiny bit of affection. Let's also not thrust our affection in other people's faces. That's not just to the LGBT community, but to anyone. But the fact that the bar owner is stepping up and saying, no, I would have done this to anybody, that's so oddly progress. Yay, we're almost there. I don't know where there is, but it feels like progress, and therefore I covered that story. Such an odd note to end this week's show on, and yet that's what I'm doing. I'm ending on that note. Our huge, huge thanks to Melissa Farrick. I cannot tell you what an unbelievable treat it was to have the opportunity to speak with her. I've been following her forever. I've seen her so many times. Go download her album on iTunes. Our thanks to everybody over at the It Gets Better Project and our allies over at Doritos. That sold out super quick, so I would keep an eye out. I'm interpreting that they're probably going to come out with more of these Doritos Rainbows bags, so keep an eye out and we'll see if we can't get you guys a bag. Just watch social media. It's coming. I think it's coming. I'm predicting it. You guys get out there. Do whatever it is that you do to use your voice in your special way to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. Whether you are writing a new song, whether you are creating a new snack chip that helps support the LGBT community, use your voice to make a difference. And while you're out there using your voice to make a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?